Hi, Jake Werner. Welcome to KABU.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Great to be here.
Jake Werner is a research fellow at the Quincy Institute for Statecraft. His research and writing examines the emergence of great power conflict between the U.S. and China, and he develops policies to rebuild constructive relations. Jake is also a co-founder of Justices Global, a grassroots organizing project that advocates for reforms in the global economy, and is co-founder of the organization Critical China Scholars, a network of academics engaged in public education on Chinese politics and society. So, Jake, we'll be concluding this interview with how the U.S. and China can resume our cooperative relationships. But first, Jake, tell us about how the relationships fell apart and increasingly belligerent words and also actions ensued that, in fact, make the front pages of our newspapers that could escalate into the unthinkable war.
Yeah, it has been a really remarkable and terrifying erosion in the relationship, particularly since Trump was in power, but it started before that. I mark it a turning point at the 2008 financial crisis. The United States economy, of course, was really devastated. The Chinese economy was also badly damaged, but the Chinese economy recovered relatively quickly. And at the same time, Chinese government had been buying up a lot of U.S. Treasury bonds to store its foreign exchange earnings. So one of the, to me, symbolically important moments in the turn in the relationship was when Obama first visited China. Many of the headlines interpreted that visit as a supplicant going to bow down before China. And so you could see there already the sense of insecurity on the U.S. side, that this country that previously hadn't been taken seriously as a competitor or as a rival power suddenly seemed to be in the superior position. It's taken a long time for some of these negative feelings to develop and eventually become policy, and it really took Trump to catalyze all of this. But the tensions have been growing for quite a while. As China gets more powerful and as American power has weakened or eroded, there are all these economic tensions as Chinese businesses became competitive with American businesses, and as access to the China market got harder for American businesses. And then there's increasingly a military component. Significant frictions developed in the South China Sea under Obama already, with China worried about the United States hemming it in militarily, and the United States worried that China was trying to take over the entire South China Sea. And most recently, and most dangerously, around Taiwan, an island that China claims as its own, even though it doesn't rule it, and that the United States has an interest in making sure that there's no coercive reunification between China and Taiwan. For many years, there had been a tacit agreement by the two sides to kind of let the status quo go, where Taiwan was self-ruled, but China maintained its claim on Taiwan. The United States agreed not to take steps that would permanently separate Taiwan from China formally. Increasingly, both sides don't believe that the other is committed to that status quo. And so across the full range of economic, military, and as well as cultural and political issues, you have questions around democracy and human rights, questions around American hegemony in the world. Each side thinks that the other is trying to diminish them, and they're taking actions that they think are defensive in nature that the other side regards as aggressive in nature. And both sides are having a hard time appreciating the sense of insecurity and threat that's being felt on the other side, and are just lashing out against what they take to be aggressive moves by the other side. So the two sides are not communicating well. They find it very difficult to be empathetic to the concerns on the other side. And increasingly, they're militarizing their relationship, trying to exclude the other one from economic and military presence in the world. So it's been going in the wrong direction for quite a while, and that's starting to come to a head now.
Just on a day-to-day level, they're military maneuvers by their warships and fighter planes are often shadowing one another. Dangerous accidents happen. And then there's the increasing hostile worlds, like my predictions of war. And of course, the military-industrial complex here is always looking for a dangerous threat that must be stopped. So they magnify the threat. Those kind of conflicts make vivid pictures on TV. So people see it for themselves, how China is so aggressive. And then there's the revival of antipathy towards China for stealing our jobs. rather than blaming the real culprits for globalization and problems of the American working class. Anyway, one thing that we have to talk about, I think, fairly briefly, Antony Blinken's trip to discuss all of these problems. He's going to China very, very soon. In fact, before this interview airs, we're pre-recording.
He'll be having his meetings on Sunday and Monday.
Right. Tell us, you know, briefly what you think is not much is going to happen is your sense, but what's your take on it?
Right. I mean, this was as the relationship deteriorated, and the relationship deteriorated quite a bit further after Biden took over and essentially kept all of the Trump policies, including really harsh tariffs and a lot of restrictions. For example, Chinese journalists. Trump had closed down consulates in China, and China had retaliated for each of these measures. So Biden essentially preserved even the Fulbright program, the educational exchange program Trump had closed down. This is a really inoffensive program to have American students studying in China that the Biden administration has declined to revive. So pretty much everything that Trump had done, the Biden administration kept on. But on top of that, then the Biden administration pursued further restrictions and did so through effective outreach to American allies. The American allies are the most powerful and richest countries in the world. So that is particularly threatening to China. These are also, many of them are the former colonial powers. That makes them an issue of sensitivity in Chinese nationalism, because Chinese nationalism is built around the claim that the Chinese government is allowing China to stand up against and escape from imperialist domination. So the Biden administration pursued this agenda of further restricting China's economic and military power. It did so more effectively than the Trump administration, and that caused the relationship to decline ever further. So the first couple of years of the Biden administration, the relationship was near collapse. And then we got Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, made a trip to Taiwan that enraged the Chinese side, because any sort of official contact in Taiwan sort of imply a recognition of the independent status of Taiwan. So this enraged China, and it pursued some military exercises around Taiwan that kind of were dry run at executing a blockade of the island. So this, I think, really alarmed the Biden administration that things were starting to run off the rails. They don't want a war. They do want to limit Chinese power and influence. They don't want a war. So after that point, the Biden administration started to switch in a more diplomatic direction. And the outcome of that was Xi Jinping and Joe Biden met last November in Bali as part of the G20 leader summit. They had a long conversation. They agreed that they didn't want to have conflict. They agreed that there were some areas that two countries could work on. And they talked about Blinken visiting China as follow-up to that. So that was scheduled for February. That visit, however, was canceled after the Chinese spy balloon suddenly appeared over continental United States. And so that led to another round of acrimony between the two sides.
That's really comic opera, that episode, that it was taken seriously. And
it was taken very seriously, particularly by members of Congress, used it to inflate the threat of China and demand confrontation. So the Biden administration didn't take it so seriously. And the Biden administration, I think, wanted to get the Blinken visit back on fairly quickly, but China responded very negatively and refused essentially to take calls from America for a couple months. So what has happened now, China is experiencing its own difficulties. The economy is not running very smoothly. China is very worried about getting cut out of the global economy and is also worried about the possibility of military conflict. Chinese leadership does not want that. So they have sort of gradually opened back up to the idea of high-level talks. And the Blinken visit now is, there's been a couple of high-level contacts. The Blinken visit is kind of the formal resumption of diplomacy between the two sides. But as you said, I am pretty pessimistic about whether any real progress on the deep differences between the two sides will come out of this visit. The U.S. side has said explicitly that it doesn't expect any real progress. They just want to stabilize things. Whether things can be stabilized when each side regards the other as a potentially existential threat, I am skeptical that you can stabilize relations when you're dealing with that kind of a situation.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio, talking to Jake Werner of the Quincy Institute on statecraft. His research and writing has examined the relationship between the U.S. and China, both great powers. Tell us about Chinese worries and then about U.S. worries.
Right. So, of course, the Chinese Communist Party has this history, this anti-imperialist history of allowing China, which was victimized by the imperialist powers, especially Britain and Japan in the 19th and 20th centuries. The Communist Party has this claim to having made China strong. It stood up against imperialism. It took control over its territory, established its sovereignty. And under Mao Zedong in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, it also stood on the side of anti-imperialist movements in the Third World, supported communist revolutions in Latin America and Africa and Southeast Asia. That's, of course, its history. A lot of that history was abandoned after Mao died and Deng Xiaoping took over in the late 70s. And China really found a place for itself within the U.S.-dominated system, especially free market globalization. But this whole time, in the 80s, 90s, and the aughts, the Chinese Communist Party still insisted on maintaining its autonomy within that system. So unlike a lot of other countries, a lot of other developing countries, it didn't take on a lot of foreign debt. It didn't allow its currency system to be open. It maintained capital controls. It maintained the power to set the value of its currency. It didn't allow free movement of capital in and out of the country by Chinese or foreigners. So the Chinese Communist Party, even as it dismantled the planned economy and reformed the system along free market lines, it gave up a lot of the control that the state had over the direction of the economy. Nonetheless, it maintained its ability to be autonomous within the system, and it maintained its commitment to managing the economy so that it would become increasingly wealthy and powerful. So rather than, for example, rather than foreign investors bring capital to the country and exploiting cheap labor, and then once the workers start to get fed up with that condition and they start to organize and start to demand more, then the capital just leaves. That has happened to a lot of developing countries, and as a result, those countries never really develop. What China did was it offered really attractive terms to foreign capital, a gigantic workforce that was highly educated and well-disciplined, and the state would come in and repress any unrest if it should happen. The state would use its power to force workers to be good workers, to be exploited by capital, foreign capital. But then it made demands on foreign capital and said, you have to invest here. You have to invest in raising and upgrading the technology in the economy. You have to build out these sectors that will allow the economy to develop. And so the government managed this process in a way that allowed China to increase its wealth and also increase the standard of living in the country, which it had to do because it was afraid of unrest that could challenge the legitimacy and power of the Communist Party. It was able to unleash development in China that other countries within free market globalization were unable to achieve. So China found a place for itself within American-dominated free market globalization, but it did so on its own terms, and it rejected the U.S. claim to set the rules for everybody. So this, in turn, always upset the United States. The United States was constantly lecturing China about its human rights record, about it not doing enough to support American priorities like isolating North Korea or Iran, or, you know, supporting American initiatives in the Middle East, or accepting all of the free market doctrines that the United States wanted to spread all over the world. So there were these tensions all along between the two sides, with China really insisting on maintaining its autonomy and doing things in its own way, even though it was a free market way, it was its own way. And the United States resenting that. We had these tensions throughout this period, but because both sides were really invested in free market globalization and both sides, at least the people in charge, were benefiting from that, it was possible to maintain a pretty cooperative relationship. So what changed is that after 2008, that free market globalization broke down. It was no longer growing quickly. It was no longer, a lot of the free market doctrines were discredited. That led the United States to feel like everything was falling apart. A lot of American leaders who just took American power and free market doctrines and the particular concept they have of democracy and human rights, a lot of American leaders who took those just as sort of God-given, the proper way that the world should run, they were really disoriented when that whole system started to erode, and they weren't able to put it back together again after 2008. And I think that the way, even though China didn't in any direct way cause any of these problems, because China had always stood out and not accepted American power and not been the kind of unrestricted free market paradise that American leaders imagined, China really stood as a symbol of something different. A lot of American leaders, they have worked through their difficulty understanding the direction that the world has taken these last 15 years by blaming China. Like, China is identified as sort of a symbol of all of these problems that America is having. It stands for, you know, in their minds, China stands for authoritarianism. It stands for state control of the economy. It stands for rejection of the rules-based international order, which is the same thing as whatever the United States wants. So in some way, China is the symbol of all these problems for America, and we can fix these problems if we can just exclude China and diminish Chinese power and influence, limit the ability of its economy to grow. We can rebuild American leadership. We can rebuild democracy, human rights, free markets, if we can just unite behind excluding and diminishing China. So I think these are the dynamics that are in play. And of course, that determination to diminish and exclude China to the Chinese leadership, that's a revival of the history of foreign imperialism and the attempt to keep China subordinate forever. So even though the Chinese leadership is not anti-imperialist in the same way that the revolutionary leadership was in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, it still has the kind of instinctive revulsion against the idea that China could be permanently subordinated within the American system or cut out of the most advanced opportunities for Chinese growth, or the ability of the Chinese system to stake a claim and say, look, there should be room for diversity of different societies, shouldn't just be whatever the United States says. So you get a real incompatibility between these two sides. And both sides are capitalist. They both have free market institutions. They both have tremendous degrees of economic inequality. They both have weak labor movements. Government is generally not welcoming of stronger labor power on both sides. There are terrible racial inequality in both countries. There's terrible gender inequality in both countries. There's actually, the two countries actually have a lot in common, but it's very hard for them to recognize these commonalities because each one is envisioning the other as the primary obstacle to its own ability to grow and flourish and affirm its values.
Yeah, we have to conclude. Thanks, Jake Werner, for talking to us.
Wonderful talking to you.
Yeah, good talking to you.